Up on this episode, a whole bunch of Cinegear stuff, and the lead story, the Fuji GFX 100, is going to be coming out this summer. We're going to talk about why that is so exciting, and more stuff on the Week in Film Tech, May 31st, 2019. Hey everybody, this is Charles Hayne for the Week in Film Tech. If you're watching this on YouTube, you've probably noticed that there's like a changing, color-changing light. I'm playing with the NAN light, which I saw at NAB, so you should look out for a review of the Nanlite RGB battery-powered tubes at some point this summer. For those of you who are just listening to this podcast on audio, just picture in your mind a battery-powered four-foot tube that's on RGB color change mode. Just picture that sort of in the background, sort of a disco party effect. All right, so the big news this week is all Cinegear-related stuff. So a little bit of context for those of you who don't know. The big trade show in motion pictures has always been NAB, right? And the National Association of Broadcasters in Vegas every April, 4 days. It's always traditionally been the big deal in motion pictures. However, for the last 20 years or so, Cinegear in June in Los Angeles has been sort of pulling more weight. A lot of people are going there. Maybe fewer people are going to NAB. I'm still a big NAB fan. I still really support NAB. I think it's a really great trade show. I also really like that it's in Vegas because then everybody who's there, it's like summer camp. We're more likely to see each other at night. We're more likely to cross paths. That doesn't happen as much at Cinegear because everybody who's local sort of goes their own way. But because Cinegear is cine only, you know, NAB always has like all of these booths that I don't care about, like satellite transponders and things. And I'm a nerd and I don't care about them. Cinegear is cinema gear. They have their thing, and that is just movie stuff. And what's interesting is in the last couple of years, we've started to see a lot more of the major vendors who might traditionally have rolled out a product at NAB, rolling it out at Cinegear instead. 2 years ago, the EVA-1 at NAB was just under a cloth, and then it came out at Cinegear. So Cinegear is sort of gaining more prominence, because even if it's a product like the EVA-1 that's going to have a lot of broadcast applications, Cinegear is starting to get more and more of those big announcements because manufacturers want the filmmaker halo you get out of announcing at Cinegear, not NAB. So even a product like the EVA-1, which has a big broadcast application, they don't announce it at NAB, they announce it at Cinegear to give it that like filmmaker vibe. What are the big things already announced for Cinegear? The week before a trade show is always a big time. I mean, a lot of stuff gets released at the trade show, but the week before the trade show, you start getting a lot of press releases, you start getting a lot of embargoed news. I can't talk about anything that's embargoed, obviously, but I can talk about stuff that is already public. And the first big thing that is already a big, huge story is the Fujifilm GFX 100. Now, full disclosure, if you're watching this on YouTube, I'm shooting it on a Fujifilm X-H1. I shoot a lot on Fuji. I've been shooting almost exclusively Fuji for the last 2 years for stills work and a little bit of video work. And big Fuji fan. People ask me why. Color reproduction, color reproduction, color reproduction. I really like their color reproduction. That is what I like about it. It grades really easily. I bring up really nice images quite pleasingly, and the stuff straight out of camera is great. And that's why I am mostly Fuji these days. There's a little bit of Canon in my workflow, and then when I can, Alexa and Red. You know, because obviously, if you can have a real cinema camera, you should shoot a real cinema camera. Trying to turn stills camera into cinema cameras doesn't always work. But I've done a lot of video stuff on the X-H1 and actually been very impressed. And the X-T3 is obviously a huge hit in the video space. So, why is this $10,000 medium format GFX 100 such big news? At $10,000, you have a lot of options, right? A lot of the reasons why we're using still cameras to shoot video stuff, the X-H1 is like $2,100, the 5D Mark II when it first came out was like $3,000. There's all, you know, the Panasonic GH5 was like $1,500. There's all these great $1,500 to $3,000 cameras that can give us these beautiful images, and when you just want beautiful images, you go for that. At $10,000, you could afford a used Red. You could afford, I mean, maybe even a used Alexa. I think I saw one once for like $12,000. There's like stuff around at $10,000. If you want to go new, which a lot of people do because you want to get the most years out of a product, there's still stuff like the C200 and the EVA-1. There's all these options. However, what's interesting about the GFX 100 is that it is a medium format sensor, and Fuji's been very public where they're skipping full frame. So the X-H1, the X-T3, all of those cameras, they're roughly super 35 millimeter sensor size. One of the reasons why I like shooting them so much is the smaller sensor, the super 35 millimeter sensor size, which is smaller than the full frame sensor, I really like it. It gives me a little more depth of field. It gives me a fighting chance of keeping things in focus when we're really running and gunning. And I like that. But Fuji is like, we're going to go straight from super 35 size to medium format size. So you can't, we shouldn't be expecting a full frame, like a full frame mirrorless out of Fuji the way Nikon and Canon just came out with cameras last August. And before that, Sony, like 3 years ago, came out with full frame mirrorless with their Alpha line, the A7 and the A9s. You're not going to see that out of Fuji. Fuji's like, no, we're going straight to medium format. Medium format sensors are even bigger than full frame sensors. They're really big whopping sensors. And it's really interesting that the GFX100, they've had cameras sort of in this price point for a while. Their G-Line came out a couple of years ago, and the G-Line and the G-Mount are their medium format mount, the way their X-Mount are their Super 35 roughly sized mount. And what's interesting about it is the GFX100 is the first one where they're really promoting the video features. It is full DCI 4K. You can get H.265 at really high data rates to the internal. You're getting full 422 10-bit on the external via HDMI. So you pair this thing with like a $1,200 Atomos Shogun, you're getting full 4K 10-bit 422 files. Hopefully, maybe Fuji will open up something for RAW. Nikon's doing RAW over HDMI now, so maybe we'll see that out of Fuji. And you're getting it off this massive whopping sensor. Now, you could already do this out of a Hasselblad. In fact, like 2 years ago, I shot with a Hasselblad 50C, and you could get these really beautiful images out of it. However, that camera was very clear. We're a stills camera with like a little video mode, and all of the stuff from Fuji has been we're a stills camera with a little video mode. And this is very much the camera from Fuji where they're like, video is a real thing in this. And that's super exciting. So if I don't like full frame, why am I so excited about medium format? Well, medium format's not going to dominate everything. Not every job I'm going to do is going to be on medium format. If I'm doing a run and gun night exterior documentary shoot, I'm still going to keep it on a smaller sensor, like a Super 35 sensor, because that extra depth of field is going to make sure that more things are in focus. But what's interesting to me about Fuji doing this with the GFX100 is there's going to be certain jobs where medium format gives you a completely different image feeling, not just because the sensor is bigger, meaning you get lower noise, right? As the sensor gets bigger, the photo sites get bigger. As the photo sites get bigger, they need less light to create an image. So you're getting better low light response, less noise in low light situations. There's like all sorts of perks of that. But it's also the field of view of the lenses are totally different because the sensor is so much bigger. The same focal length of lens gives you a completely different field of view, and you feel it in the imagery. The imagery looks perspectively different because different lenses are being used to give you a same field of view. So it's a dramatic difference. I feel like it is a bigger difference than the Super 35 to full frame difference. The Super 35 to full frame difference is a difference, but it's not quite as dramatic. So for me, I'm excited about medium format because when there's the right job for it, where I am doing a job where it makes sense, being able to bump up to that dramatically different imagery seems really worth it. And so I actually kind of like where Fuji is landing in terms of those two. Obviously, there's a lot of people out there shooting with Sony who love it. There's a lot of people out there shooting with the Canon RFs who really love it. Like there's a real benefit to the full frame as well. But then for me, I'm like, if you're going to go for the smaller depth of field, you might as well go all the way up. The other interesting thing about Fuji doing this is that Fuji's X-Line has really great autofocus, and you are seeing the same autofocus and processing tech in the GFX100 that you're seeing in the X-T3. And Fuji is really known for their glass, right? Color reproduction and lens quality are their big things, which are great things for camera manufacturers to build their reputation on. And the G-Line glass, I haven't shot with it, but I've heard nothing but good things, that it's really beautiful glass, and you're going to have really beautiful Fuji glass paired with a bare array sensor, but with Fuji color processing and with the same sort of autofocus technology we're seeing in the X-T3, I think we're going to see a camera that maybe even has usable autofocus in medium format, where you can use the autofocus a little bit in video mode and have it be give you usable results. Obviously, autofocus is something a lot of filmmakers usually avoid because of that horrible searching thing where it's like dancing, but the eye autofocus in the X-T3 has been something people have really appreciated, and I think we're going to start to see, or face detect autofocus, I think we're going to start to see some interesting results. I can't wait to get my hands on the GFX100. I think it's going to be a super exciting thing to have a tool that gives you that big sensor size within like the affordability range. Obviously, 10 grand, most of us aren't going to buy it, but we might be able to rent it. Within that range to be able to do some really cool stuff, I'm very excited about that kind of accessibility coming to the motion picture market. Now, interestingly, Hasselblad also make these big whopping sensors. And, you know, they were putting out 4K video 2 years ago, and they're owned by DJI now. So I think this also means within a year, we'll probably, or maybe two, we'll have a interesting application from Hasselblad and DJI. Now, the one caveat I obviously have to say, and most of you already know what I'm going to say, which is rolling shutter. If you don't know what rolling shutter is, because of the way digital imagers work, you can have a global shutter or a rolling shutter. A global shutter takes the whole image at once. A rolling shutter starts taking the picture at the top of the picture and moves it to the bottom of the picture. And rolling shutter artifacts, if you've ever moved a camera a lot and your image has looked a little jello-y, that's a rolling shutter artifact. You'll also see rolling shutter artifacts when you shoot stuff like propellers, where the propellers look rubbery. Rolling shutter artifacts are a result of not only the rolling shutter, but also processing intensity of that image. As the sensor gets bigger, you're going to have more rolling shutter artifacts. So like when I tested the Hasselblad a couple years ago, really bad rolling shutter artifacts. The 5D Mark II, really bad rolling shutter artifacts. It is part of the nature of a bigger sensor, especially when a bigger sensor first comes out, that you're going to get some rolling shutter stuff. And then as processors get faster and as technology improves, you get fewer rolling shutter artifacts than you did before. The first Red One had bad rolling shutter artifacts, and now we don't really worry about it nearly as much because the processing is better. And the GFX100 is almost definitely going to have some rolling shutter artifacts to work around. You know, it's definitely going to be a camera that you want to work with, probably on a stabilizer, on a tripod, on a slider, those kind of things. It's not going to be like the handheld run-and-gun monster that you might see from other cameras. Now, we're starting to move towards the place where there's some global shutter cameras out there on the market, which is super exciting. You're probably not going to see global shutter cameras, though, in medium format quite yet. But then that, a couple years out, we're really excited to see that. That's the Fujifilm GFX100. It's coming in right under $10,000. It will be out this summer. I've been pestering the people I know at Fuji, being like, when can I play with one? Obviously, I think the still photo people are going to get to play with the press unit first. And then after all the still photo people have done their reviews and whatnot, the motion picture people will get to play with it for a week or something. And at that point, we will write up our thoughts on it. So be on the lookout for that with the GFX100 sometime this summer. Up next, NVIDIA has rolled out a whole line of NVIDIA Studio laptops. Now, obviously, NVIDIA is not making these laptops. These laptops are made by Asus. Full disclosure, I was once in an Asus ad. I was playing a film director. If you can find it online, it's kind of hilarious. I was directing an action scene. I was just friends with the director. I don't really think I even met anybody from Asus, just the ad agency. But still, mentioning a brand I've worked with, I should say I was in one of their ads. So Asus and HP and Alienware and all of those big laptop makers are making these laptops. But NVIDIA is really the one who's pushing this news cycle. And they're pushing this news cycle because they've done a lot of deep work with Red. And we've talked a little bit about NVIDIA and Red getting real-time playback out of the RTX platform. And so we've got Quadro RTX cards, and we've got GeForce RTX cards, and the GeForce are the more affordable ones that you're probably going to start to see, you know, within the budget of most indie filmmakers. And they're giving really phenomenal results. Now, all 17 of these laptops are PC only. However, all of the press releases around this news is comparing them to the MacBook Pro. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the context behind that. So Apple, for a long time, there were NVIDIA cards and there were AMD cards, and they went back and forth. Those are the two big makers of graphics cards, NVIDIA and AMD. And traditionally, filmmakers have always preferred NVIDIA for reasons like this. Like, NVIDIA works really closely with Red to make sure they're getting really amazing playback on those kind of things. Like, NVIDIA has rolled out a lot of amazing technology that is catered more towards the creative space. AMD makes really phenomenally powerful cards too, but they also make processors, and their focus has been more traditionally just on gaming exclusively, without rolling out as much of those tools that also make the cards useful for creative professionals. However, Apple hasn't made a laptop or anything with NVIDIA in it since 2013. All of these technologies, like all of the RTX platform that they've worked on with Red to get those amazing playbacks, their CUDA technology, all of that has been unavailable to Apple users for 6 years now. And that's one of the reasons why many filmmakers have switched to PC, is to get access to all of that NVIDIA power. And, you know, they're laying out in their press release that they're getting results that are 7 times as fast for certain processing activities on their PC laptops with these new cards as they are in a MacBook Pro. Yes, in certain activities, you can see results like that. It's important to remember a couple things when you read these things. One, not everything is GPU focused. So if you've played with the Blackmagic eGPU or anything like that, which is also an AMD platform, most people have had the results that I've also had, which is some things are really going to benefit from CPU and some things are going to benefit from GPU. So for instance, you're going to get really good results transcoding using Red Cine and a powerful GPU. That transcoder is GPU optimized. But a lot of applications, if you're just transcoding footage from one format to another, it uses the CPU quite heavily, and bumping up your GPU is not going to speed that up. Applications like noise correction using Neat Video or the Noise Corrector in Resolve or something like that, you're going to see tremendous benefits from the GPU power at it. But you're not going to see it in other things. So will switching from an Apple to PC mean that everything gets 7 times faster? Absolutely not. Will certain dedicated activities get 7 times faster if you switch from an AMD MacBook Pro to a NVIDIA RTX laptop and you get one of the more powerful NVIDIA RTX laptops? It is possible. You're going to see certain GPU benefits in certain arenas. Now, of course, Apple is trying to combat this, and Blackmagic is trying to combat this because they know people are very loyal to Apple for a wide variety of reasons by building things like the eGPU. I think we're going to see a lot more things like that coming out in the next year or two that enable the people who want that power in a MacBook Pro to get that power in a MacBook Pro. But if you do go PC, you can just go get one of these NVIDIA Studio branded laptops and just have that power without having to get an external. However, you know, there are trade-offs to that. If you're considering the switch, you should know that, you know, there's going to be the benefits of that, but then you're going to lose out on a lot of, like, easy flexibility of ProRes, easy flexibility of workflows with other professionals. Apple is still pretty dominant, especially in the creative filmmakery space, so it's sort of interesting to see this battle heat up. And I didn't want to let all of these laptops and the big marketing push NVIDIA is doing around it go without being mentioned. All right. In our first wave of actual, full, official, like, they're calling it Cinegear news, in their release, the Fujifilm GFX, it's just timed for Cinegear, which I thought was very sneaky, but it wasn't like officially like releasing at Cinegear. In fact, Fujifilm is doing their big Cinegear thing, not around the GFX 100, but actually around their new Permista zooms. In our first official Cinegear news, Panavision, Los Angeles-based camera manufacturer and rental company, they previewed last year at Cinegear a variable ND, and this year it is out, it is available, you're going to be able to work with it, and it is a liquid crystal ND filter. And that's super exciting for a lot of reasons. Now, it's Panavision, so it's probably going to be rental only, because that's their whole deal. There's only two Panavision items that anybody knows about that you can buy, one of which was a prop. Like, they took an old Panavision camera and they took out the guts and they made it a prop for a Universal Studios ride. And that one showed up on eBay once. And then I think the other thing that showed up on eBay was one of the cameras that were used to film Titanic apparently fell off a submersible and they got recovered by a diver. So that wouldn't even be a real, like, Millennium Panaflex. That would be like a Panaflex Airy 2C that had been converted with a 2,000-foot mag and a Panavision mount. But it still says Panavision on it, and you can own it. And that's, as far as I know, the only, like, ownable Panavision stuff, except from the very, very early days of Panavision. They're a rental-only company. That little digression aside, Panavision, rental-only company, they made these liquid crystal variable NDs. Why is that so exciting? So a variable ND has been around for a minute, and all that means is, you know, liquid crystal, like your TV, LCD TVs, liquid crystal displays. It is a clear piece of glass. So first off, let's explain an ND filter if you don't know what an ND filter is. ND stands for neutral density, and neutral density means it is a filter that should provide no color cast whatsoever. It's a filter you put in front of the lens just to darken the image. So if you're working day exterior, but you want to be at a wide aperture because you want that shallow depth of field, you could use an ND filter so that you can open your aperture up and keep the same exposure. A vital part of the professional filmmaker's toolkit to have really powerful, really nice NDs available. Panavision, very high quality imagery, very focused on the best of the best. And they've just come out with a variable ND. So how does the variable ND work? It's exactly like your TV. It's a clear piece of glass, but it's a liquid crystal display, and it can get darker or lighter electronically. This has been around for a while. There's a couple cameras that have it internally. I think the FS7 Mark II, although that might be a rotating dual polar. It's been a while. But this is technology that exists that is a variable ND LCD. Why is it so exciting that it's coming from Panavision? Well, because a lot of the ones that have been around, the color has not been the best. There's been inconsistencies in the color cast as you go throughout the aperture range and things like that. And, like, you haven't seen a lot of applications of it. Like, making it successful, making it beautiful, making it give you the quality of results that Panavision users expect is what's really exciting about this. Like, obviously, it's going to be really well built, and it's going to be very easy to use, and it's Panavision, so it's going to work perfectly with the Panavision system, and we're going to see great stuff out of that. But the really exciting part about it is that this technology is in a place where Panavision's willing to put their name on it, which is a rare thing out of Panavision. Panavision is very, Panavision and Airflex are aiming at the top of the top. That is their market share, and they're not going to put their name on a product that then gives you a horrible green color cast or makes the skin tones look terrible. Like, that's just not what they do. So it's a really cool little piece of kit. You should totally check it out if you go to Cinegear. There's buttons on the side, so you can click through the stops of ND. You can also plug it in wired to the camera. You can also wirelessly control it. You can do smooth aperture ramps, or you want to do a focus ramp where you're moving the aperture on the lens and you're moving the variable ND. You can coordinate and sync all that together. This is also particularly exciting on the Panavision platform, because the Panavision DXL platform does something I think is really cool. If you don't know the DXL, the Panavision DXL is the digital XL, and there's a whole bunch of things that are cool about the DXL. It is a red body with light iron color processing, but Panavision sort of accessories. But the really cool thing about it is the Panavision XL lens mount is a powered lens mount, which you don't see a lot in motion pictures, right? Your still photo lens, it can control focus, iris, and zoom with the body of the camera. You don't really see that in motion pictures, but with the Panavision DXL, you do. And what's so cool about that is then focus, iris, and zoom can be controlled by the camera body. So now the camera body, if you plug into that ND filter, can do both the iris and the ND together, so your exposure stays perfectly the same, but your depth of field changes because your aperture is changing. That's super cool. So there's a lot of stuff you can do that are super cool about all of that because of these technological developments and this powered lens mount. So it's really interesting to see all of that happening. All right, everybody. So I won't be at Cinegear this year, unfortunately. I have a young baby at home, and she's the light of my life. And a young baby means you have to choose between going to both NAB and Cinegear, and I picked NAB this year. Hopefully I'll be back at Cinegear next year. But everybody should totally be on the lookout for all the stuff we just talked about and all of the new stuff. And I'll be back next week with a report on all of the stuff that broke over Cinegear that I wrote about and that you guys might have missed out on, and we will talk about it all next week. Be sure to subscribe. Tell all your friends about the podcast, who are also like film gear tech nerds. We're available for subscription, where all of the subscriptions are available. We're also on YouTube. And I email out a mailing list every week of just like links to articles for the stuff that I am talking about. So you can go to weekinfilmtech.com to subscribe to that mailing list or to subscribe to the podcast. And I will send out an email when the episode goes up saying, hey, new episode, and here's the stuff I talked about. You can always reach out to me on Twitter at Charles Hain. You can always ask me questions on Twitter, and I will try and answer them on the podcast. And I will see everybody else next week after Cinegear. Those of you who are going, have a good time. Wear a hat. Don't get too much sun. And I will talk to you all next week.